In our next session, we're going to have David Galloway speaking to us, and then Max is going to come as well. Again, I'll let them introduce themselves to you and tell you what it is they're coming to talk to us about. We'll also have a session to just get a little plug from the bookstore, and then later on you'll hopefully have more opportunity to get down there and see what they have on offer. So David, if you want to come, thank you.
Well, good morning everyone. It's a great pleasure to be here and to be part of this organized conference today on confident Christianity. You've probably seen a little bit of the bio, so I'm not going to dwell on that at all. You can read what you need to read from that. Let me just say a word or two by way of introduction. This is a topic, I think, which is important to me for two reasons. And actually, the reasons pick up threads that have been mentioned already by what Andy had to say in his introductory comments and also what Mark had to say. We think of ourselves, don't we, as living in a very sophisticated, evidence-based society. Indeed, that's the way that we run our lives. And yet the reality is that no matter who we are or where we are, we still are inclined to find ourselves believing some things which are entirely without foundation. And I want to expose some of that thinking today. We're going to be focusing particularly on the topic of life's design. And the second reason I think this is important is this. There are so many people in our society who believe, as you've been hearing from Mark already, that the neutral, unbiased, evidence-based position is that there is no design at base. And I want to look at that with you and challenge it, because I think as Christians, we find ourselves very much on the back foot. We live in a society that has this view. It's out there. It's in the public square. It's the accepted position. It's got the street cred. And yet, in reality, the position is that it's very different from what is currently considered to be the standard view. I should have noticed, actually, I've got a starting point here because there's a little timer on my desk. I'll maybe hold off for 5 minutes and then start it. So the whole question of life's design is something which is utterly mocked by some very famous card-carrying scientists. Some of them you'll be familiar with. They've made a huge amount of money from selling their publications and writing their books and so on. And some of the background to that is something which I think needs to be challenged, because what I want to show you is that Christians need to come off the back foot and be confident, because they have a message which is not only evidence-based, but is intellectually credible. And that's part of my mission, to convince you that what you have is an intellectually credible message. And we'll try and do that in the next 25 minutes or so. Let me introduce you to this man. This is William James. I would forgive you for not knowing much about him. He was a Harvard graduate in the 19th century. He qualified in medicine, although he never actually practiced medicine. He did teach anatomy in the university in Boston at Harvard for a while. But he became known as one of the United States' most prominent academic psychologists. And he actually finally wrote a book on psychology, The Principles of Psychology, which ran to two volumes, 1,200 pages, published way back in 1890. But one of his passions was to do some of the things that we do, and that is to make some of the intellectually evidence-based, credible science available to a rather less scientific audience. Now, some of you will be scientifically trained, some of you will be involved in healthcare, some of you will instantly recognize some of the material that I show you today. But some of you will not. And this is what James was doing. He was trying to get the message out. And on one particular occasion, the story goes that he was presenting his tale of how the Earth was no longer the center of the solar system. The sun was the center and the various planets were in orbits around the Earth. And he was giving this talk in a small American town. And at the end of his presentation, this rather determined-looking elderly lady approached him and said, "Mr. James, you know, it's all very well for you to talk like that and to tell us about how the sun is the center of the solar system and all that stuff about the planets revolving around. It's incorrect. It's all nonsense. I've got a far better explanation." So James politely inquired as to what her explanation was. And she said, "Well, the Earth, the crust of the Earth, sits on the back of a giant turtle." So James didn't want to be too aggressive about this, although he clearly had all the evidence at his fingertips. And he said, "So, madam," as he politely inquired, "on what does the turtle sit?" Without a moment's hesitation, she said, "Well, it sits on the back of a second, bigger turtle." So James began to think he might be in a little bit of difficulty at this point. He was asking the questions just as Andy had suggested would be a good thing to do. And that second turtle, she said, "It's no use, Mr. James. It's turtles all the way down." And so there was the first suggestion of an infinite regress in middle America in the 19th century. Of course, it had pretty much gone from Enlightenment thinking in Europe perhaps a century or two before that, but nevertheless, it hadn't quite permeated into her thinking, and that was the position that she held. Now, what do you do about that? Is it turtles all the way down? Is it just pure chance, natural law? How do we explain what appears to be life's design? You look at a structure like this. You probably noticed just about 2 or 3 weeks ago, the Chinese-American architect who was responsible for conceiving the structure in the Louvre in France, it's been a museum, as you know, since the 1790s, but he produced this monstrosity at first that's now considered to be an iconic feature of the Louvre, and I.M. Pei, who was this architect, died just 2 or 3 weeks ago at the age of 102 and has been hailed as the creator, the designer of this amazing structure. Now, you don't look at that and assume that it just happened by chance. I mean, it's obvious just from the structural integrity, the forethought and the foresight that goes into it, that that's something that's been designed. You go to Prague and you'll see this building. Evident also from its structure, this is the Dancing House in Prague, that it's been designed. You look at buildings all around the world, the Wanda Cultural Center in China, the Atomium in Brussels, the Cube in Rotterdam, and this rather fetching building here, which is in Hyderabad. You'll never guess what that is. It's the National Fisheries Board in Hyderabad. And clearly it's been designed for a particular purpose. And there's evidence of this really all over the place. You just look at any cityscape and you cannot escape the notion that this has been put together in a purposeful, integrated, balanced, and perhaps not so well balanced way, but for the purpose that it exists. It's clearly designed. We see evidence of design. Now, looking at life, you'd be forgiven for identifying structures like this, and you'll instantly identify that as, well, is it just some kind of pattern that could have come together by chance, or is it actually positively, deliberately created and designed? How about this? Well, you can see the structural integrity, you can look at the symmetry, you can look at the segmentation, but think also of the function that's here. And there's lots of this that just can't be explained when you get into thinking about metamorphosis and so on and how these things develop. And there's evidence of these patterns and designs all over the place. People talk about the golden ratio, which you sometimes see in nature. You see it in the shells, the Fibonacci sequence, you know, where you take a series of numbers and you take two numbers and add them together and get the next one. So you get 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13 and so on, all the way up. And this is the kind of pattern that you identify in some forms of life. Now, is that just something that happens? Or is that something that's been designed that way? Here again is the Fibonacci sequence, this time in a spiral allo, and the so-called logarithmic spiral, which comes through in some of this. The issue here seems to me that actually some of these things you could probably sell as patterns that emerge just for no very deliberate reason. I think you could probably push that and accept it. Looking at an insect eye, however, you can see that there's structural integrity there. You can see there's balance. There looks like it's been designed. But in behind that, there's an entire neurological system that deals with information decoding and processing and reinterpreting. And as soon as you begin to get code into a situation like that, or rich information that means something, then that's a deal breaker as far as design is concerned. That has to be a designed entity. There is no getting away from it. So how do we recognize design? Very quickly, we can look at structure and you can see right away that one of these two structures has been deliberately crafted for a particular purpose. Going beyond structure, you get to function. You take any of the musical instruments that have been performing already today, and you can see that they've been put together structurally for a particular purpose. And you wouldn't hesitate to think that these have been designed. Beyond that, you get into my world, and this is a picture of a surgical robot here, a surgical stapler up here, and you can see that there is all sorts of computer software behind this, and so instantly you've got the business of language and code and information processing and so on. And to even assume for a second that that comes together in some kind of natural, random way is clearly totally preposterous. So what do we make of life's design? I spend a bit of time on the island of Arran, and I love to go there. And actually, Scotland has probably about 40% of the world's population of northern gannets. You ever watched gannets fishing? It's great entertainment, I can tell you. I was watching them just last week. Gannet is about the largest seabird that we have here. I'm going to show you a little video. In fact, I'm going to show you in the next couple of slides some videos which show evidence of design. In part, life's design, and then I'm going to take you to the Tesla factory just for a moment. But have a look at this. These are gannets fishing. They've been incredibly adapted. They get up to a height of about 60 or 70 or maybe even higher feet, and they plunge into the water like that. There they are in slow motion, and they are seeking their prey. They've been specially adapted such that their beak is cushioned on a kind of spongy, bony plate to absorb the impact. Their eyes have a kind of membrane that flips over just before they hit the water. It's an incredible piece of engineering, and there they are catching their fish. Quite astonishing. Now, you can look at this kind of example in all forms of life and see evidence of engineering at this level that looks like it's been particularly set up for a purpose. Or you look at some of the state-of-the-art engineering that exists now in some of our manufacturing systems. These are the robots that exist in the Tesla factory. Look at this particular robot here, which is putting in the seats into the car. It's a multifunctional, very versatile robot. Not only does it do that, but once it's got the seats in, it picks up the windshield, and you'll see it applying the glue to the windshield. Here we go, it brings it into position. There's the glue being applied. The windshield is set in position. Now, would you think for one moment that a robotic setup like that just somehow happened to come together? Of course you wouldn't. Absolutely preposterous to imagine that. And yet, I'm going to show you shortly some other robots, but you're being asked to believe that these are entirely randomly assembled. And we'll come to that shortly. So if I was to try and pull together some kind of design definition, and it's not particularly easy, it would have words like these, with specification, with function, with foresight and planning and structure and all the rest of it. And we'll come to that shortly. So what I want to do in the next, how long have I got? 15 minutes or so. We'll look very quickly at some aspects of design. In particular, I want to look at the difference between patterns and designs. We're looking at examples of both so far. I want to introduce you to what happens in biological systems, molecular machines, and then we'll look at the enigma of information before we consider whether it's turtles all the way down or genuine design. Now, people like Richard Dawkins recognize what appears to be design, but it's an illusion. Just like any belief in God is a delusion, so design in nature is only an appearance of having been designed. And he talks about how things have been certainly put together for some particular purpose. Any engineer can recognize an object that's been designed, even poorly designed, and he can usually work out what the purpose is by just looking at the structure. And you could certainly apply that to living systems. But he says it's all natural. It's just the result of random mutation, natural selection, and while it overwhelmingly impresses us with the appearance of design, it's just an illusion of design. Now, is that an intellectually credible position? Here's Francis Crick, who was one of the co-discoverers of the double helix with James Watson back in the early 50s. And he was absolutely wedded to the notion that this was all the result of an evolutionary process. He says almost all aspects of life are engineered, and we need to understand the engineering, but it's not designed engineering, it's just natural engineering. And so this is the secular agenda today. This is what people accept and believe. And these, ladies and gentlemen, are your cousins. There they are, all just related to you, some perhaps more obviously related to you maybe than others, but I'll leave you to draw your own conclusions. But in order to accept this, you throw design out of the window, and this is the inevitable, indeed the only conversation that you can have. Down in the south of England, in Kent's Cavern, you can see these wonderful stalactites and stalagmites and so on. Are these designed? Well, you could argue that they just result from the minerals that are dissolved in the water, the moisture content, time, solubility of these various minerals and so on, and you get these incredible structures developing. Or you look at a tornado or a hurricane. Are these designed? No, well, you would think they're just really more likely the combination of particular atmospheric conditions with moisture and temperature and so on, and if the conditions are right, then you'll get one of these weather systems emerging. It doesn't look like someone's actually put it together and crafted it for a particular purpose. Or look at a snowflake. There's a crystallized snowflake there. Lots of examples of these. They have this amazing hexagonal structure for the most part. Are they individually designed, or is it just the result of the moisture in the air and the wind and the temperature and so on that brings this all together? These are all examples of patterns where there doesn't appear to be any intellectual input at any stage into their production. But think about this. Here is an image of Mozart. Now, Mozart, as you'll know, is responsible for all sorts of other kinds of patterns. Here's an example, symbolic representation of Mozart's work on sheet music, but the actual representation of what the music sounds like as sound waves in the air is rather different. So it exists in a couple of different forms. It's both symbolic and it's physical. Or think about this. Here's the diagram of where we are right now. There's Hebron Evangelical Church, the Google map. Now you say, in answer to the question, is this a pattern or a design? Well, it's clearly a design because it's symbolic of the reality. There's the real situation. So you can see there's already a little bit of a difference between simple patterns and designs. In order to create the design, you need some intellectual input. And that's true whether you're talking about language or whether you're talking about code. Anything that's just simply a pattern is a result of matter and energy, but anything that's a design involves intentionality. It requires intellectual input. It requires a mind. And so we're using language all the time. Is that just some kind of pattern that's emerged? No, of course not. It involves intellectual input. It's symbolic, it's coded, it represents something beyond itself, and that's something which is a feature, as we'll see, of life. When I started out in medicine, I was involved in a research project looking at the involvement of this system, which is called complement. We don't have time to go into this in any detail, but basically it's a series of proteins, all starting with the letter C. There's C1 there, C2 here, C4 there, there's C3. There's all 9 of them, and they eventually come together in this complementary system as part of the immune process to punch a hole in the membrane of an invading organism or cell. And there's the membrane attack complex there. Incredibly balanced, controlled system. All these proteins like little robots working together in a very specific way for a very specific purpose. And I was interested in whether or not this had any impact on how patients got pancreatitis. But actually, when I stepped back from that and thought for a moment, there's a much more important question here. And it's this. How on earth, from our understanding of the way things develop in life, how could something like this possibly emerge step by gradual step? Because at every single step, there would have to be some kind of selective advantage in order for that improvement, that adjustment to the system to be borne out in the next generation and so on. And when you've got a system like this, whether it's like this or whether it's the coagulation system, what you have is something which is totally beyond the reach of a gradual, step-by-step, natural selection-type process to produce. Now, I'm not a lone voice asking questions about the validity of evolutionary theory. Even the Royal Society, just 2 years past in November, had a conference where they brought some of the world's leading evolutionary biologists together because of concerns like this. That the so-called neo-Darwinian approach to understanding how life has developed all its complexity and diversity, how could it possibly come together? Well, the answer is that system just doesn't fit. And so appeals are being made to all sorts of natural genetic engineering and gene transfer and all sorts of other processes to try and explain the complexity of life that we see. Here's another quick example. Some of my work involves being in a mission hospital in the African bush. This was a baby I delivered. I'm not an obstetrician by any standard, but nevertheless, I did have to deliver this baby by cesarean section. The tragedy here was that the mother almost lost her life because of profound blood loss. Her life was preserved, but her pituitary, the little tiny pea-sized gland in the base of the brain sitting in a bony saddle there, it was damaged because of low oxygen levels because of her dramatic blood loss. Now, the pituitary is an incredible little structure. One of the things it does is it drives the human breast to produce milk. It produces a hormone called prolactin. Without prolactin, there's no lactation, and so this woman had no way of feeding her baby. Now, in Central Africa, that's a huge problem. And here in Aberdeen, no big deal. You get down to Boots, you buy some formula, you get some bottles, problem solved. In Africa, there is no Boots. We did actually manage to solve the problem in Africa, and it was a very simple solution. The answer was, buy the family a goat. That solved the problem. But the reality here you have a system that not only looks after lactation, but also looks after not just breast function, thyroid function, adrenal cortex, sex organs, bone and muscle metabolism, salt and water balance, the whole range of things, all controlled in an incredibly integrated, balanced way with positive feedback, negative feedback, all sorts of levels of control. Even the controlling hormones themselves are controlled. It's astonishing. Here's another quick example. We don't have time to go into this in great detail, but think about the changes that have to take place right at the get-go when you're born. In the womb, you survive because of the oxygen coming from the placenta, and it comes up in the circulation in via the liver into the heart and is distributed around the rest of the circulation, finally finding its way back to pick up more oxygen in the placenta. A very different position from the in-series pattern following birth or in the adult. And it actually works in parallel because of three shunts, the ductus venosus, the foramen of Veyle, and the ductus arteriosus. I'd love to be able to elaborate that for you in a bit more detail. The reality is all of these shunts have to close as soon as the baby is born. When the baby is born, the placenta is shut off right away, so there is no oxygen supply. That baby is dead or severely compromised unless there's a very rapid solution to that problem. Now, did this just emerge in some way? And if so, what is the possible mechanism that might explain this? We need to get rid of these various shunts. The amazing thing about the shunts, actually, and I'll just mention this one brief feature, is this, that when this oxygen-rich blood is coming from the placenta here, making its way back to the heart, selectively it needs to be distributed to the organs that really need it, to the heart, to the brain, to the kidneys. How does it do that without just admixing with all the rest of the oxygen, less rich blood that's there? It does it in an amazing way. It comes through one common channel, but the oxygen-rich blood selectively is streamed by the design of the anatomy to make sure that it goes through the particular shunt here, the foramen of Veyle, in order to be distributed to the brain where it's particularly needed and to these other organs. Now, that's astonishing. Not only that, the blood that's coming back from the superior vena cava and from the inferior vena cava here, these blood streams are also while they're in the same vessel, they are spun and selectively distributed in such a way that they go through the tricuspid valve and into the pulmonary circuit. It's quite an astonishing level of engineering that's present there. And if we had time, we'd go into that in a bit more detail, but we don't really have time. I wanted to show you the molecular machinery of these robots. This is ATP synthase, which is a molecular machine. But let me just get to show you the molecular machinery in action. Within our cells, we need all sorts of structures to move things around. And this little protein, this is an animation of a protein called kinesin, which walks its way along microtubules. It's quite astonishing to see this in action. But more important than that, and with this, I'm going to draw this to a conclusion. Back in 2001, the human genome was sequenced for the very first time. It took about 13 years, took about $1 billion to do it. Now they tell me you can do it in about an hour for $10. So it's a dramatic change. But the way that DNA is It's a double helical structure. Many of you will know this. It has to be pulled apart in order to be replicated, for cells to divide, for people to be born, and so on. And the structure is based on this sugar backbone here. And this can only be presented to the enzymes that replicate the DNA in a particular conformation. So there's just some of the enzymes that are involved. There's the one which pulls the two strands apart. It's an astonishing robot. It spins at about 10,000 RPM, so the same speed as a jet engine in the cruise. And then you've got the enzyme DNA polymerase, which actually does the copying. And if I show you an animation of that in action, I'll ask you just to reflect on what you've seen already from the Tesla factory and draw the same conclusion. Here's DNA coming in to be replicated. This is helicase here, this blue enzyme, and there's one strand being fed into the DNA polymerase and is coming out as a copied double helix. The other strand is the wrong way around, and so it has to be drawn out into these loops, into fragments called Okazaki fragments. And these are drawn out into these loops and presented to the other DNA polymerase up here. And you can see the kind of coordination and balance and so on that's involved in this process. Quite astonishing. According to Dawkins and Crick, this is all just something which has emerged entirely by chance. There is no design behind that. Now, you don't think for 1 minute that that's the case, but that is what they try to sell us. There are two levels of complexity and difficulty here, and with this I'm going to wind up. Here's the first. If you're on the beach and you see something like this, there's, 15 letters, 16 characters if you include the question mark. When you see something like that, you do not think for 1 second that that has randomly assembled and hasn't been deliberately put there by some mind. It's been designed. That's the first thing. Second thing is this. And in some ways, this is even more perplexing. We won't quite get to the detail of this morning. But this is what's known as the information enigma. So, thinking about all the protein robots and the molecular machinery, which came first? Was it the protein machinery which is required to decode and to replicate the DNA? Or was it the DNA which is required to manufacture the protein machinery? You lie awake in bed at night and wonder and worry about which came first, the chicken or the egg. Well, I'm here to tell you the answer to that question. They both came first, of course. You need them both. And the only way you can get them both is by design. The evidence points to intelligent causation. Now, I had a little bit more to say about information. We're going to maybe just hold off at that because my time is gone and I don't want to overrun. But the important thing is this. What we have is evidence that points in a completely intellectually credible way, not to an illusion of design, but to real design. And so you can point to any of these examples. And in fact, if you want a particular question to ask your skeptical friends, put it this way. And this is something which none of them have been able ever to answer. I'm not sure it's one that Andy uses, but if not, maybe he'll consider using it. But think about this. Is DNA, this code, is it a language? Let me just show you this. It has an alphabet, it has grammar, it has meaning, it has intent. Is it a language? Or is it just some kind of random pattern? Well, it's clearly coded information. All languages have a will, have an intellectual base, have a mind behind it. DNA, therefore, must have an immaterial source. Here's the challenge. Ask your atheist friend, show me a language that doesn't come from a mind. And if you can do that, I'm prepared to entertain your ideas with some sympathy. Otherwise, design, folks, is real. Turtles all the way down, genuine design all the way down. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I'm going to invite Cliff up, and he's going to give a short book plug, highlight a couple of things. And Max is going to get set up for his talk. And as he's doing that, you can stretch a little bit, but please don't go away. Hopefully you'll be able to use this mic here, Cliff. And I'll then let Max take over.
Well, I hope you're enjoying the conference so far. It's been very good, very informative talks. My name is Cliff, and I work for CLC in the Academy Shopping Centre. We have a good range of books today. We've got Andy's book, The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, and a couple of David Robertson's as well. Just a couple that I picked out. One is Can We Trust the Gospels by Peter Williams, who I just found out has spent some time here. And he goes through really thoroughly, predominantly non-Christian sources on the Gospels, looking at the culture, the language they use, and seeing how accurate they are to that time from non-Christian historical sources. So that comes highly recommended. This one I read myself recently, Is God a Moral Monster? By Paul Copen. I really enjoyed this. It looks a bit academic. I got into it, and he goes into, again, the historical sources, cultural context of the day. But ultimately, this led me to praise God, led me to rejoice in his grace, that he's always been gracious. He's never lost his temper flippantly. He's never been inconsistent in his grace and his love toward mankind. And he's always been good, and it led me to praise God for Jesus Christ. So, highly recommend this one. Thank you.
Great. Well, it's great to be with you all. This is actually my first time in Aberdeen, my first time speaking at a Solas event, hopefully not my last. I'm watching my time like a hawk. Yes. Okay, so what can historians tell us about the figure of Jesus? Basically, what I want to do in the time I have is to sketch out for you the sort of situation as it exists in mainstream historical study of Jesus by professional historians, and really just hope to give you a little glimpse into the way that actually the sort of core of the story of Jesus is really quite historically robust. And I think I like the way Mark put it in terms of a significant task of apologetics is really just about dismantling structures of falsehood. And we are up against significant structures of falsehood on this topic, but actually not so much in terms of the professional historians who study Jesus, but more in terms of the vast quantity of stuff that's out there on the internet and by popular atheist figures who actually are largely very unfamiliar with what real scholarship on the topic is saying. So I sort of dubbed these sensationalist sound bites, but this is just to give you a flavor of the kind of thing that's out there and that is shaping the mindset of the average person on the street. So Christopher Hitchens, the late journalist and author and famous atheist, says that the contradictions and illiteracies of the New Testament have filled up many books by eminent scholars and have never been explained by any Christian authority except in the feeblest terms of metaphor and a Christ of faith. The French atheist philosopher Michel Onfray goes even further and says that Jesus' existence has not been historically established. No contemporary documentation of the event, no archaeological proof, nothing certain exists today. And I think you'll find that if you talk to a sort of typical secular person who's not really looked into the topic, they will assume that this represents this sort of cutting edge state of the art thinking on these historical questions, but it really does not at all. These are two actual scholars who study the historical Jesus, and neither of them are Christian apologists by any stretch of the imagination. E.P. Sanders, I think, is fairly agnostic, and Bart Ehrman is agnostic-leaning atheist. But this is what E.P. Sanders says in one of his major books on the topic. He says, there are no substantial doubts about the general course of Jesus' life, when and where he lived, approximately when and where he died, and the sort of thing that he did during his public activity. Bart Ehrman, who is sometimes known actually as someone who kind of bashes Christianity a bit in his more popular books, actually is a lot more sober and measured in his more scholarly work. And this is what he says, that no serious historian doubts the existence of Jesus. We have more evidence for Jesus than for almost anyone of his time period. Okay, so what are historians looking for when they try to sort of get a handle on what can they start to know about a particular historical figure or time period? Well, one thing they want to know is when they have some documents, some historical documents purporting to tell about a time period or figure, they want to know, is this source in a good position to know what happened? Is the author writing relatively close in time to the events? And where did they get their information? But the historians also want to ask the question, okay, when we look at these documents, so in the case of Jesus, things like the Gospels, Paul's letters, some non-Christian sources, which we'll get into a bit later, do these, when they tell these accounts of Jesus, do they fit? Do the detail, the little minor details, do those fit with what we know more generally about the time period and place in the case of Jesus, first century Israel? So, you know, if you have a source that says that, for instance, there was this battle in medieval France and that the soldiers were using crossbows, but if we actually know from archaeology and other sources that crossbows were not used in medieval Europe, well, that should tell us that there's something a bit wrong here and this source doesn't really know what it's talking about. On the other hand, if it gets those sorts of things right consistently, we're much more likely to say, okay, this is someone who's close up to the facts. They know what they're talking about. And then thirdly, historians will want to ask, are there other sources? Do we have more than one independent source that tells roughly the same kind of story? We don't expect to see agreement on all the tiny details. And if we did, actually, we would suspect they're not really independent. But do they agree on the kind of core? So let's look at these questions then with respect to Jesus and what historians can say about those documents that talk about Jesus. So I think it's helpful first to make some comparisons with other notable figures in the ancient world and just consider the time gap between the life of that figure and the earliest source that was written about them. Just to see that actually the situation with Jesus compares quite favorably. So Alexander the Great, hugely important figure, of course, in ancient history, kind of conquered much of the known world on behalf of Greece. The earliest source we have today that talks about Alexander's life comes from 120 years later. And nonetheless, historians today think that they can reconstruct a lot of information about Alexander's life. So they're not troubled by this big time gap. The Emperor Tiberius was the ruler of the world. He was the emperor of Rome around the time when Jesus was crucified. The earliest source we have today that gives details about Tiberius's life is the writings of the Roman senator Tacitus, 77 years after Tiberius. And again, historians today are not troubled by that time gap. They're confident that we can reconstruct a lot of information about Tiberius's life. The situation with Jesus is considerably better. The earliest surviving sources we have today that give details about Jesus' life, most scholars think, are the letters of the Apostle Paul, written, the earliest of them, within 20 years of Jesus' life, definitely when eyewitnesses were still alive, and moreover, Paul was in contact with many of the key eyewitnesses. But then, as for the rest of the New Testament sources, especially the Gospels and Acts, well, virtually all historians agree that even the latest gospel is within 65 years of Jesus' life, still within kind of eyewitness range, if you like. And the Mark's gospel, probably the earliest, is considerably earlier than that. So when people say, oh, the gospels were written so long afterwards, we can't trust them, they actually need to take stock of the comparisons with what's normal for ancient history. And when we do that, we actually see the situation is really quite good in the case of Jesus. And we'll go on to see in a moment, there are a number of reasons for thinking not only were these documents written early by the standards of ancient history, but there's also many indications that they get right all these little details that would have to come from accurate eyewitness recollection. So as for this question, how well do the Gospels which are, at the end of the day, and I will talk about some non-Christian sources, but in terms of the where we get the bulk of our information about what Jesus did and said, it does come from the New Testament Gospels. And that's acknowledged by historians that it doesn't, just because they were written by Christians, we can still use them as historical sources. There are various tests we can apply to them to think about how accurate they are. And here is one very important sort of test, or family of tests, really. How well do these documents kind of cohere with what we know the conditions of life were like in Jesus' time and place? Sort of the geography, the customs, the way of life, even the patterns of personal names, that we'll come onto that in a minute. So the Gospels show a remarkably high degree of accuracy when it comes to their knowledge of the sort of landmarks and geography of first century Palestine. This is an example that gets quoted a lot, but it's worth mentioning. So in John 5, you know, there's this scene where Jesus heals this this person who's been lying ill by a pool for 38 years. It's called, in John it says it's called the Pool of Bethesda, and it says it's near to the Sheep Gate in Jerusalem. And moreover, it has five porticos. Now, skeptical scholars at the beginning of the 20th century said that John's probably just making this up for symbolic value. The five porticos represent the five books of the law, and the man is under the law until Jesus kind of liberates him and so on. But then in 1956, the Pool of Bethesda was excavated, and it matched John's details precisely. And what's striking is that most of these pools that existed in that place, in that sort of era, would have had four porticos, four arches. But this one unusually had five, and it indeed was near to the Sheep Gate in Jerusalem, and so on. And so, and actually there are many other discoveries of places that only John's Gospel mentions that have time and time again turned out to vindicate John's accuracy in terms of his geographical knowledge. And there really is, I think, no other conclusion that this information must ultimately come from an eyewitness source. Just another example, Capernaum is a town, of course, where Jesus sort of based himself for his Galilean ministry by the shore of the Sea of Galilee, on the northwest shore. And the Gospels give lots of sort of details about Capernaum, including that it has a harbor, a synagogue where Jesus teaches. It seems to be where Peter and his brother Andrew live. Evidently, there's a fishing trade because Peter is a fisherman. And Jesus heals a centurion's servant, suggesting there's a Roman presence there. And when Capernaum has been excavated, all of these things have turned out to be present. There is indeed a significant harbor. A first century synagogue has been found there. There does indeed seem to have been a Roman presence there, which is it's not just that every little town in Galilee had a Roman garrison. But in particular, Capernaum seems to have had that. Also a customs house. Remember, Jesus calls Levi the tax collector in Capernaum, so that also fits. And archaeologists even think that they may have found the house of Simon Peter, believe it or not. You can ask me later if you want to know why they're confident that it's actually Peter's house. So the Gospels also show considerable familiarity with the kind of way of life that was particular to this part of the world at this time. So there's this fishing boat that was actually discovered not very long ago. The tides were particularly low in the Sea of Galilee one day, and this boat kind of protruded out, and they managed to sort of rescue it and preserve it really well. It's in this museum just by the Lake of Galilee now. And it fits the kind of dimensions that it would have needed to be in order to carry Jesus and 12 disciples. And it's got a stern platform where you would throw nets off the back. And it actually kind of fits in interesting ways with some of the parables Jesus tells about fishing. We found these tombs which fit the description of the kind of tomb in which Jesus was buried. a tomb cut out of rock, a sort of cave tomb with a circular stone that would roll across the entrance, and also a heel bone of a crucified man. So some skeptical scholars have wanted to say, oh, crucifixion victims would not have been given a proper burial. But this bone, this turned up just by chance, really, because mostly, you know, the Romans would have pulled the nails out of the bones. In this case, they couldn't do that because it got caught up. And so, really, it was just by chance that we have this evidence. But this is, you know, clear, tangible evidence that even crucifixion victims were given the proper Jewish burial. Finally, this I really like this one. Richard Borkham's a New Testament scholar who and others have talked about this really interesting pattern that you find when you line up what we know about the sorts of names people had in first century Israel. That we know from things like tomb inscriptions and so on. Then you compare the relative popularity of those names on the tomb inscriptions with the relative popularity of names in the Gospels. And the pattern is really quite striking. So let me try and illustrate that for you. So basically there's this database of about 2,500 names of people who really lived around the time of Jesus in Israel. And you know, that's you can really start to say, well, how many, what proportion of the men were called Simon? Okay, and so in this database, about 9.2% of the men were called Simon in Jesus' day. It's the most common male name. Well, in the New Testament, Simon is the most common male name. But it doesn't just end there. When you actually, and I won't kind of read out this whole list, and as Andy said, you'll get these slides. The pattern is really quite striking. That you've got the right proportions. The matches are not perfect, but you wouldn't expect them to be. But there's just no way you could, if the gospel authors were sort of sprinkling fictional names of people around their gospels, there's no way that they would get these accurate patterns that match the real-life relative popularity of the names in Jesus' time and place. Particularly given that most scholars would say that the four Gospels were probably written outside of the land of Israel. So, for instance, Mark's Gospel was probably written in Rome. The earliest tradition we have about that says that it was John Mark who wrote that gospel based on Peter's preaching in Rome. But the point is just that suppose that gospel really was written in Rome. Well, the patterns of even Jewish names in Rome were quite different from the patterns of names in Israel. So someone who wasn't getting their information from an eyewitness source close to the facts would not be able to just make up patterns of names that really matched the relative popularity of the names in Jesus' time and place. And this again just kind of goes to give us confidence in the kind of access that the gospel authors must have had to the information about Jesus' life. It's these little details that, you know, they would never have thought that we 2,000 years later would be able to check this kind of stuff, but we can. And when we see that they get these little details right time and again, that gives confidence of the kind of authors they were, the kind of information they had, and the kind of care they took. Now, here's something that's important. I said historians are interested in seeing that we have not just one source telling about some event or figure, but multiple independent sources. Now, in the case of ancient history, we're often lucky if we have more than two or three sources talking about a significant event. And, you know, if there are two sources that give broadly the same story about an event, that's really great, and that gives us significant confidence that the event took place in roughly the way described. But in the case of Jesus, we have many more than just two sources which attest the kind of core or the broad outlines of what Jesus did and said. So we've got Paul's letters, as I said, probably the earliest sources about Jesus, and we'll come back to those in a minute. We've got the letter of James. It doesn't really say much, anything about Jesus' life, but it does give teaching which looks very reminiscent of Jesus' teaching in the Sermon on the Mount. Then we have what are known as the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Now, these aren't sort of, the way we think about these as sources is not so much Matthew 1 source, Mark 2, Luke 3, but more in terms of the sources that the authors of these Gospels used. So most scholars think Mark's Gospel is the earliest Gospel to be written, and that Matthew and Luke both had access to Mark and could use Mark as a source. And that's not something we should be worried by. That historians regard that as a good thing if an author is using an earlier source. That's considered good historical practice. Now, there's a bit more debatably, some scholars, but increasingly some not, think that there's another source that Matthew and Luke had access to that is not in Mark, and they dub this Q. But perhaps it was just Matthew, actually, and Luke using Matthew. There's some debate there. But in either way, there's also material that only Luke had access to. There's material that only Matthew had access to. And then most scholars would say that John's Gospel is, again, independent of the other three Gospels. So even just within the New Testament, we have at least seven independent sources, all attesting the same kind of broad outline of Jesus' life. And then, of course, we have some non-Christian sources, and I'll come to those in a moment. And so, again, this is what Bart Ehrman, again, definitely no Christian apologist, this is what he says when reflecting on the fact that there are so many independent sources attesting the same kind of outline. He says, these sources are independent of one another. They were written in different places, yet many of them, independent though they be, agree on many of the basic aspects of Jesus' life and death. He was a Jewish teacher of Palestine who was crucified on order of Pontius Pilate, for example. That these sources could not have been dreamed up independently of one another by Christians all over the map because they agree on too many of the fundamentals. Dale Allison, arguably the leading historical Jesus scholar today, again, certainly not a Christian apologist, but this is what he says. The first century traditions about Jesus, which is to say these sources that we've just been looking at, are not an amorphous mess. On the contrary, certain themes and motifs recur again and again throughout the primary sources. And it must be in those themes and motifs that we'll find memory. So this is why, basically, when you actually look at what serious mainstream scholars are saying about the historical Jesus, they will agree that the core of, not necessarily every story will they agree is historical, but the kind of core themes and core events of Jesus' life are very solidly established. So that Jesus went around preaching the kingdom of God, believe it or not, that he healed people would be virtually unanimously accepted by historical scholars today. That's not to say they would all say that Jesus did supernatural miracles. That's more of a philosophical question, but certainly that Jesus did things that people thought were miracles, that's very solidly established. And that Jesus must have thought that not just that he was proclaiming the kingdom of God, but that in some way the kingdom of God was coming in and through his ministry, if you like, that he clearly thought of himself as the king of the kingdom of God, as playing the central role in it. So these things would actually be very widely accepted among mainstream historical scholars today. And it's because you have so many independent sources all attesting the same kind of motifs. So let's just look at one of these sources, Paul's letters. Paul's letters are a particularly important source for historians because they're written so early, but also because Paul undoubtedly knew several of the key eyewitnesses of Jesus' ministry, such as Peter and James, the brother of Jesus. And the other thing is, Paul's letters are not really about the historical Jesus in the sense that They're not, the purpose of Paul's letters is not to say, let me tell you everything I know about what Jesus did in his ministry. Actually, Paul's letters are more about theology or addressing pastoral situations in the churches he's planted. So that when Paul does make, in passing, a remark about some event in Jesus' life, like the Last Supper, that's even more valuable in a way, because it's not like he's contriving to go out of his way to tell us this information. It's just reflecting stuff that he knows is completely taken for granted by the early Christians. And so here's just some of the things. Imagine, if you will, that we didn't have the Gospels at all. All we had were Paul's letters. Let's suppose just the letters that virtually all scholars accept are definitely written by Paul. This is what we could know nonetheless. We'd know that Jesus was born of a Jewish woman, that he had brothers, including one called James, that he had a special group of 12 disciples, that Peter had a special role within that group. That we'd know that Jesus' ministry was focused especially towards Israel rather than the Gentiles. We'd know that he performed what Paul calls signs and wonders, and that the core of his ethical teaching was love for one another, that he said he would return in glory. We'd know that the early Christians believed Jesus was the Jewish Messiah, and we'd know about the Last Supper, which Paul mentions in 1 Corinthians 11. And we'd know that Jesus was betrayed by someone on that night. We'd also know that Jesus was executed by Roman crucifixion. And we'd know that he was buried rather than just being left to the elements. And we'd also know about this very firm belief by his earliest followers that the tomb didn't stay empty and that Jesus appeared alive to them again, including to Peter and the 12 disciples. And we'd also know that his earliest followers, astonishingly, these monotheistic Jews, were actually giving this man the title which in the Old Testament is given to God alone, that of the Lord, and are doing things like praying to him and singing hymns about him. Okay, so let's just quickly look at a couple of these non-Christian sources. And again, what we'll see is these non-Christian sources confirm the basic outline of Jesus' life. So we've got Josephus, a Jewish aristocrat writing towards the end of the first century, has this little passage where he just kind of gives some passing details about Jesus, but which nonetheless completely fit with what the New Testament says. Now, just worth saying, most historians agree that this passage, as we have it, has been slightly touched up by some Christian scribes, but equally most scholars are confident you can subtract those little additions and get back to probably what Josephus wrote, where he says that about this time there was Jesus, a wise man, a doer of surprising works, that's very likely a reference to Jesus' miracle-working reputation, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to himself both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles, and when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men amongst us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him, for they reported that he appeared alive to them, and the tribe of Christians so named from him are not extinct at this day. Tacitus, a Roman historian writing in the early second century, just to get through this, I won't read this quote out, but again, he corroborates some core details about Jesus' life, such as that Jesus was crucified on order of Pontius Pilate, that Jesus' movement stopped briefly but then broke out again, intriguingly raising the question of what would explain that kind of breaking out again of the movement. And then we have Pliny the Younger, another Roman in the early second century, attesting worship of Jesus as God, saying that the Christians were known for meeting on a certain fixed day and singing hymns to Christ as to God. And so that even if, you know, imagine we didn't have the New Testament at all, just from these non-Christian sources, we would know all these things about Jesus. And again, I won't read these out. You can have these slides. So in conclusion then, the core of the story of Jesus is historically more assured than ever. And this is not just a conclusion of Christian apologists, but actually of mainstream historians who don't sort of have a particular kind of skin in the game, as it were. And so I think we can have confidence in the basic accuracy of the New Testament narratives. Thank you very much.